a senator from the state of Connecticut. His life has been one of service to our nation, and from this pulpit I would add it has been one of service to our and his people. For he is a good Jew, a synagogue Jew, a man who has lent the prestige of whatever office he has held to all worthwhile Jewish causes. It is my privilege to invite now to this pulpit Senator Abraham Ribicoff.
Rabbi and members of the Temple congregation, it's a great honor for me to have been invited to give this lecture, especially in this temple, where for many, many years, one of the great rabbis and great teachers in the history of our people served you and Jewry throughout the United States and the world so well. The last time I saw Rabbi Abba Silver was when he came to Hartford to be the main speaker at the 45th anniversary of my own Rabbi Abraham Feldman. Your present Rabbi Silver took me through this temple. Indeed, it was a thrilling experience. I would say that it is probably, with one exception, the most impressive synagogue I've seen. The most impressive was altogether different than this. Last fall, I was a delegate to the Interparliamentary Conference in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. And over the weekend, I went to the town of Dubrovnik on the Adriatic Sea. And being to dinner on Saturday night, a man came up to me, I don't know who he was, and said, "Senator Ribicoff, you are of the Jewish faith. Do you know that there is a synagogue in this town?" Well, I was surprised because the government had sent a guide with me, and he said nothing about a synagogue. The literature about the town of Dubrovnik had nothing about a synagogue. And he explained where I could find this synagogue. So on Sunday morning, my wife and myself went to 3 Judaeska Street, which translated means 3 Jew Street, which was formerly the heart of the ghetto in the town of Dubrovnik. And 3 Judaeska Street was like 5 or 7 or 9 or 2 or 4 or 6. You saw a series of 3 and 4 stories, gray stone fronted apartment houses, tenement houses. And we opened the door to 3 Judaeska Street. There wasn't a sign or a legend on the door indicating that this was different than any other door on Judaeska Street. And we climbed 3 flights of stairs and opened a door to a little square box of a room. The ceiling was painted blue with gold stars. The pulpit was in the center of the room. There were silver candelabra that would hold its place with your great museum connected with this synagogue. The ark was in the front with an old tapestry in front of it. And there I met 2 men, Emilio Tolentino and Abraham Tolentino. And this is the story they told me. Their ancestor, Joseph Tolentino, left Toledo, Spain during the time of the Inquisition in the year 1312. He led a small band of Jews fleeing from the Spanish persecution and settled in the town of Dubrovnik. In 1320, They founded this synagogue. It is the second oldest in all Europe, the oldest being in Prague. And since 1320 to the present time, a Tolentino, father, son, for over 640 years, were the guardians and the preserver of the great traditions of our religion and the traditions of this little synagogue. Emilio is 70, and Abraham is 72. There remain 12 Jews in the town of Dubrovnik, 7 women and 5 men, the remnant of the Nazi occupation of Yugoslavia, all old, all without children. They brought forth the Torah, and they unrolled the Torah in front of me. It was made of leather with a color and warmth and patina of the ages. This was the personal Torah of Joseph Tolentino, and it was block lettered in the year 1308. And each letter was legible and beautiful to the eye. I asked Emilio and Abraham what would happen to the synagogue when they died. And their reply to me was that somehow God had provided all these years, and they were sure that God would provide in the years to come. It was one of the most touching experiences in my lifetime to realize the love and the continuity that we Jews have in our hearts and a sense of dedication. And that's why I say that the story and the age and the preciousness of the moment has made such a deep and indelible impact upon my mind and my heart. Now, I don't know whether in Cleveland you are about ready to repeat the Tolentino legend. You've had a great rabbi, his son follows him, and his son has sons, and maybe for the next 640 years, there'll be a Rabbi Silver taking care of the temple in Cleveland. We have just concluded our celebration of the joyous festival of Passover. Our celebration was incomplete, our joy marred by our knowledge that for our fellow Jews in Russia, this was not a happy holiday, but a sad and deprived one. For weeks before the Passover, and every day during it, we were aware of the tragedy which the Soviet authorities have made of the observance of the holiday by Soviet Jews. First, there was the ban for the third year running on the public baking and distribution of matzah. Next, they ostensibly permit some communities to provide token amounts to their members, while pretending to the world that they have enough matzah. Then they officially encourage Jewish communities in the West to send in large shipments of matzah, which would, however, still be grossly insufficient to the need. But as soon as the parcels arrive from abroad, Soviet customs holds up delivery until it is too late to be used for the holiday. At the same time, the authorities initiate a nationwide propaganda campaign labeling the dispatch of matzah from abroad as ideological sabotage and ideological subversion. The assault on Passover is not new. It is a recurring feature of all Soviet propaganda against the Jewish religion. Why this persistent and virulent assault on the Passover? The answer to this question brings us to the heart of the predicament of Soviet Jewry. For Passover uniquely represents Jewish historical continuity, Jewish consciousness, Jewish identity. And it is that continuity, that consciousness, that identity, which the Soviets are intent upon destroying. Passover reminds Soviet Jews, like all Jews, even non-religious ones, of a glorious Jewish past and a living Jewish present. It reminds them of Jewish freedom, of Jewish unity, of the Jewish family, of Jewish kinship, of Jewish peoplehood, past and present. These are precisely the values, ideas, and sentiments which Soviet policy seeks to eradicate. Passover is a symbol of Jewish identity, and so it bears the brunt of the assault. We Jews are expert in the history and meaning of persecution. The last chapter in that tragic role of ours cost the Jewish people one-third of its total number, victims of Nazi extermination. Now in the Soviet Union, 3 million Jews, one-quarter of our number, the second largest Jewish community in the world, are subjected to a policy of attrition that is crushing their spirit. If I were to sum up the situation in 3 words, they would be deprivation, discrimination, de-Judaization. These 3 words go to the heart of the problem of Jewish identity in the Soviet Union. Jewish identity throughout history was always defined and molded by the interaction of the two facets of their group life, religion and peoplehood, by the consciousness of themselves as a religious people in history, by their shared memory of their historical continuity, by their awareness of being bound to each other and to their past, present, and future as a group, by the felt doctrines of covenant, revelation, and law. Many groups subjected to oppression have in the course of history succumbed to it and disappeared for all time. We Jews have not been so obliging because we have found the inner resource to withstand external pressure. These resources the Jews found in their identity and in their conscience of it. What has kept the Jews vital and creative as a people has been their constant awareness of their identity, their historical consciousness of a special commitment to a millennial tradition of law, learning, and justice within the context of their religious faith. Now, I'm not suggesting that we Jews are or have ever been a perfect people. The prophets and rabbis who have persistently castigated us throughout our history have attested to the contrary. But for all that, the Jews have been a God-intoxicated people, which is but another way of describing the Jewish commitment to law, learning, and justice. It is that proud, passionate, historic commitment which has made it possible for the Jewish people to maintain its identity and to perpetuate its vital tradition in the face of the most unlikely odds. Now, the crux of Soviet policy is tragically simple. Its objective has been, for at least a decade and a half, the ultimate obliteration of the spirit of the Jewish people within the domain of the USSR. That policy aims at destroying the wellsprings of vitality and creativity that have immemorially nourished the Jewish spirit. It intends to atomize the Soviet Jewish community, to estrange it from its past, to pulverize its identity, to stifle its awareness of that identity, to crush the Jewish historical consciousness of commitment to the millennial tradition of law and learning. In short, that policy aims at destroying and preventing every possibility of Jewish group survival in any form. At the root of Soviet policy is a false assumption that the Jews are alien, that they are not indigenous, that they don't quite belong, that there is something peculiar about them. With that grounding and deep-seated, traditional, irrational prejudice, the meaning of real facts and events is falsely distorted out of all relation to reality and given a false meaning that has significance only in terms of that prejudice. Soviet reasoning then proceeds as follows. Since masses of Soviet Jews, heir to the traditional Russian love of Zion, are eager to learn of life in Israel, their loyalties are falsely assumed to be in Tel Aviv and not in Moscow. Since they wish to have contact with American Jews, there is falsely assumed to be something sinister going on between the CIA and the Jews of, let us say, Kiev. Since the Jewish religious liturgy contains many passages of prayer for Jerusalem, Judaism is falsely assumed to be subversive. Since so many Jews demonstrate their eagerness for Jewish cultural facilities and educational institutions, they are falsely assumed to be peculiar. Since many Soviet Jews, lone remnants of families shattered by the Nazi Holocaust, wish to be reunited with their kin in Israel, the United States, or elsewhere, they are falsely assumed to be disloyal. It all starts with that first false assumption. All the distorted conclusions follow from that. As you know, the Jews have a dual official status in the USSR. They are both a nationality and a religious group. This very duality, which is a natural outgrowth of their traditional evolution, makes them a unique social entity there. And this very uniqueness causes suspicion. The very terms for his nationality and his religion are readily interchangeable. And in the social chemistry of Soviet life, these words for Jew and Jewish carry negative charges of suspicion and shame. Hostile words about the Jewish religion inevitably carry over negatively about the Jewish nationality, even for the non-religious Jew. The Soviet Union is ideologically committed and constitutionally organized to recognize the full right of every one of its 108 nationalities to perpetuate their identity and to maintain cultural institutions toward that end. Small wonder, though 50% of the Soviet population is made up of the great Russian nationality, the remaining 50% is composed of 107 other nationalities whose group needs and aspirations can hardly be denied. The crucial importance of the concept of nationality in Soviet society cannot be overemphasized. One's nationality is one of the two or three most decisive components of citizenship in the USSR. It largely determines the language one speaks, the literature and press one reads, the national history one identifies with, the customs one grows up with, the national heroes one cherishes. One's nationality is thus a profound psychological as well as cultural and political significance. It might also be said that nationality defines a man as well as a citizen. It molds his mind and heart and soul, gives him status, and provides him with a heritage of which he can be justly and publicly proud. Now just imagine, in these terms, the real meaning of the Soviet Jewish tragedy. The Jews are very much a cultural ethnic group, a nationality in Soviet terms. They are officially recognized as such, and yet they are the only Soviet nationality out of 108 deprived of all the rights and institutions by which they might live out their lives as a national cultural group. Try to imagine what this means to the Jew in the USSR. It means that the Jews are uniquely discriminated against. They know it, and their non-Jewish neighbors know it. It means that the Jews have no opportunity to maintain and perpetuate their identity, their existence as a distinct group. It means that they are being forced to disappear. It means that in their singular disability, they are deprived of their human pride in Soviet terms and are thus subjected to unique humiliation. It has now been nearly a quarter of a century that no Jewish school has existed in which a Jewish child might learn something of Jewish language, literature, and history. A quarter of a century in which a whole generation of Jewish youth is confronted with a past that is blank. There's not a school, not a class, not a textbook to fill that Jewish void. There is no institution through which the Jew can learn either Yiddish or Hebrew. There is no way for the Jew to perpetuate his heritage, for there is no way for him even to learn it. True, the history, literature, and traditions of all Soviet nationalities are taught in a distorted and falsified way, judged by communist canons of progressive and reactionary. But at least they are taught. At least the Uzbek and the Armenian and the Georgian and the Ukrainian and all the others can learn their language, can have something of their past to look to with pride. The Jews are deprived even of the privilege of learning, for example, whether Maimonides or the Gaon of Vilna or Yehuda Halevi were progressive or reactionary. Jewish history is non-history. Jewish culture, non-culture. The psychological and spiritual destructiveness of this condition is shattering. Add to this now the fact that the synagogues, the last remaining Jewish institution where Jews may still gather as Jews, are being subjected to a policy of forcible slow death. A process of attrition is gradually sapping the vitals of the whole of Jewish religion in the Soviet Union. For Judaism is the last residue, the final stronghold of Jewishness in that land. What conceivable danger is it to the Soviet Union if the Jews were to have enough matzah, or prayer books, or Bibles, or phylacteries, or talism, or religious calendars? What threat is it to the Soviet regime if synagogues remain open, or if Jews make a minyan at home? What incalculable harm can come to the country if Jewish infants are circumcised or if the Jewish dead are buried according to the ancient Jewish rite? The answer is obvious. It is all too tragically clear. There is no danger, no threat, no harm to the Soviet state in all of these. But the regime recognizes that Judaism might still provide resistance to forcible Jewish disappearance, might still spark a revival of a sense of Jewishness, and might still set Jewish hearts afire. And so all these institutions are closed, all these sacred rites and religious articles taken away. And so the pathetic yeshiva in Moscow is left with two or three rabbinical students, while scores seek admission and hundreds would come if allowed. And so congregations are allowed no official or formal contact with each other throughout the country, or with Jewish religious bodies abroad. And so fright stalks the synagogues in the form of informers and police agents. And so synagogue Jews are intimidated and fear to have anything to do with a foreign Jew who comes to pray with them, to say Shalom Aleichem to them. All these deprivations and discriminations, this policy of Judaization, this whole pattern of forcible assimilation, are set against the background of a virulent press campaign in which the Jews are portrayed in the worst light. On the one hand, the Jew is forbidden to learn anything positive about his history and heritage. On the other hand, he is confronted in the daily press, in the special atheist journals and publications, and in university courses with a massive propaganda assault which can only baffle, humiliate, and crush his spirit. This propaganda teaches that the Bible is one of the most viciously reactionary and benighted books in the world, that the Jewish patriarchs were immoralists and plunderers, that the ancient Hebrews were nothing but slaveholders and imperialists, that the spirit of Judaism is commercial and exploitative, that money is a god of Jewish religion, that the Jews are worshippers of the golden calf. The Jew knows that, though Yiddish is considered the language of his nationality, he cannot learn it, and he has precious little to read in it. He knows that Hebrew is an unlanguage, proscribed as a language of both clerical reaction and bourgeois Jewish nationalism. And he learns from all the sources available to him that the traditional and millennial Jewish religious attachment to Zion and to the Holy Land and his natural affection for Israel is considered politically suspect, potentially or actually subversive. And for the past 3 years, the daily press has dinned into the minds of the Soviet population and of the Jews the belief that the Jews play a sinister role in the country's economy. The traditional anti-Semitic doctrine that the Jews are money worshippers, consumed with greed and single-minded dedication to the pursuit of the ruble, is constantly purveyed to the public. This is done in no merely abstract way. It is tied to the massive nationwide campaign against economic crimes such as embezzlement, bribery, corruption, currency speculation, for which capital punishment was reinstated 3 years ago. So far as we can tell from the Soviet press, 198 death sentences have been handed down in that period, of which at least 102 and probably more were meted out to Jews. Here then is a concrete way in which a Soviet regime reinforces the anti-Semitic stereotypes with which its press is full. Though the Jews constitute little more than 1% of the population, the country is led to believe that they are guilty of the kinds of economic crimes which warrant death, to the extent of 50 to 55%, and in some areas like the Ukraine, 80 to 90%. On the plane, I picked up the current issue of the Reporter magazine, which has a very interesting article on this entire subject, and I'd like to read these excerpts. Just how large is a secret sector of the Soviet economy? It is estimated that private enterprise amounts for some 25% of the Soviet gross national product. The activity is widespread, vigorous, and often concentrated. Even though the state has declared war on clandestine operators, it has not yet employed the broad powers it granted itself in a series of loosely worded decrees that extended the death penalty to economic crimes in 1961. Against that background, the economic crime trials that have been in progress since mid-1961 must be viewed as somewhat misleading, if not fraudulent. It is also worth noting that more than 50% of the defendants receiving death sentence have been Jews. Press reports have consistently stressed the Jewish identities of economic offenders, while failing to identify other defendants. And the press has accompanied these reports with a profusion of virulent anti-Semitic articles. At the same time that the fury of the firing squads is concentrated on the Jews and other less favored elements of the Soviet population, guilty officials and Communist Party members go untouched. For example, the chief of the Vilna Communist Party was caught dealing in automobiles. But instead of being expelled, he was put in charge of production planning in a Vilna enterprise. Caught in illegal deals in the second job, he was expelled from the party. But the journal Party Life announced a few weeks ago that his colleagues on the Vilna Party Committee had revoked the expulsion and restored him to membership. Now, can you imagine how this official vicious incitation is greeted by large segments of the Soviet population, in which anti-Semitic prejudices are still deep-rooted? And can you imagine how all this affects the spirit of the Jews? Why, even a young Soviet Jew, atheist, communist, ignorant of and indifferent to Jewishness, will be agitated and insulted by the deprivations and discriminations and the public stereotyping of the Jews. That young Jew will somehow also feel himself affected by the incessant propaganda that Jewish history is a history of reaction and slavery, that the spirit of the Jewish tradition is money, that the Jews are responsible for the country's shortages and economic ills. That young Jew will feel offended for his father, who has no Jewish newspaper to read and no Jewish theater to attend, for his mother, who cannot have matzah, for his grandfather, who cannot go to the synagogue in peace, for his uncle, who yearns for some news of Israel and is afraid to seek it. And he will be offended for himself, for he must realize that his Jewishness is reviled, his humanity is degraded. So the wholesale brutal assault on Judaism and Jewishness not only deprives Soviet Jews of their rights, but affronts their self-respect, besmirches their honor, and lowers their dignity among their non-Jewish neighbors. Thus is an ancient and illustrious community ground down, its spirit and consciousness pulverized. The objective of this policy is, of course, to make the Jews as Jews disappear. This is what I mean by de-Judaization. They are not to be made to disappear as human beings, but they must be forcibly assimilated by the simple means of depriving them of their cultural and religious rights and institutions. In time, after two or three generations have lived out their lives with not the slightest opportunity to learn or know anything at all about Jewishness, Jewish consciousness and Jewish identity will grow faint and quietly expire. By then, there will no longer be a Jewish nationality requiring cultural rights, no longer a Jewish religious entity requiring religious rights. There will no longer be a Jewish problem. The Jews will fade softly into the night, a full-scale assimilation. Thus will the unbroken millennial chain of Jewish history be shattered on Soviet soil. Thus will the Soviet Jewish community, heir to a great and ancient civilization, secular and religious, in Yiddish, Hebrew, and Russian, become a dead end of history. For the time being, the policy of de-Judaization is not succeeding, for the deprivations and discriminations are having the effect of throwing many Jews, especially young Jews, back on themselves. Like all Jews everywhere, only more so since it happened to them, they were traumatized by the Nazi devastation and later by Stalin's anti-Semitic deprivations. Like most Jews everywhere, they were inspired by the creation of the State of Israel. This continuing policy of deprivation and discrimination is having the effect, for many of them, of stiffening their backs. So they go to a performance of Yiddish folk songs and dramatic readings, and even though they don't know a word of Yiddish, so they try to find some matzah for the Passover even though they don't really know what Passover is all about. So they throng to the synagogues on certain joyous holidays to sing and dance and just chat with fellow Jews, even though they aren't the least bit religious. So they resist in response to the oppression. But oh, what a wrong is being done them. And how long can they continue to resist with nothing substantial to sustain their religious and cultural growth? Can it be that this great Jewish community will be no more? Can it be that this rich soil of Jewish vitality is doomed to disappear? Will the world remain silent in the face of this spiritual atrocity? And are we to remain silent? In the face of the miracle of creative Jewish survival, after 2,000 years of dispersion and persecution, there'll be a foolish prophet who would dare to predict the spiritual end of Soviet Jewry. But it would be even more foolish and dangerous to rely on miracles. If there is hope for their future, it lies in their own courageous resistance and then in our determination to do everything we can to bolster their resistance and their spirit. It is for us here to speak out for reason and justice. We must bring comfort and hope to that last great remnant of East European Jewry. It is a community with a special claim on the conscience of all mankind. For let us face the historical truth. Neither we nor the rest of the world did enough to save the Jews of Europe from devastation and destruction. We, all of us in the West, Jews and Gentiles alike, owe a debt of shame and conscience. It is a debt we cannot repay the dead, but their heirs and survivors in the USSR bear their claim on the conscience of us all. We owe it to the dead to save the living now. We must break through the pall of bland indifference, of polite acquiescence that prevails about the plight of the Soviet Jewry. If it is thought of all in the world at large, it is only as an afterthought. Governments are not agitated by it. Leaders do not speak about it. Humanitarian movements do not make it a rallying cry as they do of other deserving causes. It has not been made a priority problem at the United Nations, one of the forums where it belongs. In short, it has not become what it must be, a major item on the agenda of the world's conscience. In this country, it is essential that private and public voices be raised in protest. Within our government, the Senate of the United States has historically been one of the most effective forums for expressing officially the aroused conscience of our country. On several occasions during the past 15 years, the Senate has by formal resolution denounced Soviet transgressions against human rights. Now it must meet this solemn responsibility again by condemning religious persecution behind the Iron Curtain. In September, I introduced Senate Resolution 204 for this purpose. 63 senators from all parts of the country and representing different points of view in both political parties quickly and firmly joined in its sponsorship. They shared my belief that it is time for the Senate to take an official stand on the Soviet government's systematic policy of Jewish persecution. The Senate's voice, when raised in official protest, can have forceful impact. The Soviets are stung by vigorous and sustained criticism. The recent protests of individual senators have already irritated a sensitive Soviet nerve. The recent commutation of a death sentence of a rabbi was a small but significant reaction to a protest that is only now beginning. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Fulbright, has assured me that hearings will be held on my resolution. I am hopeful that they will take place at an early date and be followed by prompt passage of the resolution. The Soviet government will feel the force of public opinion aroused in this nation and throughout this world. Since Soviet Jews are utterly helpless, defenseless, and without voice, we must do for them what they cannot do for themselves. We must give them voice. We must rise to their defense. We must cry out for justice, justice. We cannot keep silent so long as justice is not done. We must give the world no surcease until the world pays attention. We dare not rest until we have aroused the conscience of humanity. To the suffering Soviet Jews, we must say, with a strong, constant, unyielding voice, we have not forgotten or forsaken you, nor will we ever.